For the Climate Discussion Nexus, I'm John Robson, with the latest readout video from our Wednesday Wake Up newsletter and a tip of the eye shade to Las Vegas, where viewers have made it number 27 on our all-time list by city. And with a question about the summer of 2024. Namely, what's with the ongoing drumbeat of stories insisting that this was the hottest year ever, that July 2024 was the hottest month and all that stuff? One reason that I ask is that for months, we've been hearing from people who are not personally having a notably hot summer, let alone the hottest ever. And now even the Met Office, that's the UK's official all-in-on man-made climate change weather service, just said, quote, the UK has had its coolest summer since 2015, according to provisional Met Office statistics, end quote. So are they embarrassed? Heck no. Instead, they had the gall to X out a comment that, quote, I don't think it will surprise anyone that this summer has been cooler than average for the UK, end quote. What? Why wouldn't it, since we've been hearing nothing but warnings about record-breaking heat all year long? Now, of course, you do have to beware of anecdotal evidence, including about how stairs were less steep in my youth and it was uphill to school both ways. But another incident does make us think that the weather services are gaslighting us. We woke up at the cottage one morning to be told by the weather network that it was 25 degrees Celsius, but feels like 32. Rubbish. If anything, it felt like 10. I had to put on a sweater to eat outside. But whatever happens outside the window, inside the computer, it's the hottest year ever again. And speaking of data, Ottawa, Canada's capital, had one hot week this summer. But it was nothing record-breaking. Never once in July or August did it reach what used to be 90 degrees Fahrenheit and then became 32.2 degrees Celsius. On the other hand, by September 3rd, the overnight low was into single digits. And then it had its coldest September 8th high temperature in three quarters of a century, since 1949. But what of the bigger picture? Well, for aggregate data, we think the best satellite series is the one from the University of Alabama at Huntsville. And it said that August 2024 was slightly warmer than July, continuing a surge that began, possibly coincidentally, right when the Hunga Tonga eruption spewed vast amounts of natural potent greenhouse gas water vapor into the atmosphere. But, unusually, in their word, the Southern Hemisphere was contributing most of the high temperature, suggesting that anecdotal claims of normal or cooler than normal summer in much of the Northern Hemisphere are plausible. And here's the critical thing. The models didn't predict this happening in the Southern Hemisphere, and now that it has happened, they can't explain it. So they can't even keep up with reality, let alone get ahead of it. Surprised now? Hey there, just a quick reminder about subscriptions. We're this close to 100,000, so if you have already subscribed, thank you very much and enjoy the programs. If you haven't, click the button here, get us to 100,000 and beyond. And now, back to me. Oh, and on the subject of predictions, the Thwaites Doomsday Glacier is stretching out its death scene, and ours, in ways that would embarrass a 19th century opera company. But, according to a new study, it will all be over soon. One story says, quote, one theory suggests the glacier could soon begin to collapse into the ocean like a row of dominoes, end quote. Unless it doesn't, because another story says, quote, Antarctica's Doomsday Glacier isn't as vulnerable to collapse as we thought, end quote. Boy, just can't get enough of that settled science. Now, the first story is actually a weird bait, switch, and switch, comes from the conversation via Inverse, and says, quote, a new study of Thwaites Glacier's susceptibility to what's known as marine ice cliff instability offers some hope, but the findings don't mean Thwaites is stable, end quote. No, they mean climate is so incredibly complex that even the behavior of one part of one glacier baffles those who really are experts on it and study it for a living, offering continual surprises whose meaning escapes them. The second story, which is from Scientific American, says, quote, Antarctica's riskiest glacier is a disaster in slow motion. But in a rare bit of good news, the worst case scenario for its collapse may be off the table, end quote. And then it adds, quote, human activities that warm the planet, such as burning fossil fuels, are having dramatic effects at the poles. People's choices today will determine how quickly the water rises, end quote. So, you get the same conclusion, no matter what the inputs are. But here's the really good bit. They're actually the same story, word for word, in two different publications, both thrashing around between gloom, reassurance, and uncertainty with dogmatic conviction. So, Stay doomed. In the newsletter, we also note a Canadian newspaper saying that the leader of the formerly fringe British Columbia Conservative Party, which is now surging in the polls, was kicked out of the provincial Liberal caucus in 2022, quote, over tweets that said carbon dioxide was not causing climate change, a stance significantly at odds with the scientific consensus, end quote. Which they seem to think is a bad thing. The public? Not so much. Oh, and the New York Times runs a guest essay, quote, how should we mourn the end of summer, end quote. That's right. Day after day, the Times howls that summer has become mind-bogglingly, life-threateningly hot because of our carbon sins, and now they're sad it's over? Still, we're always looking for a bright side here, and we note that Euronews Green offers, quote, tips on flight-free travel across Europe from a woman who won a race from London to Istanbul, end quote. Which sure beats tips on flight-free travel from elitists flying about to deliver them. Especially since the winner of the contest, Eleanor Parker, managed to cover that entire distance in just 57 hours using only public transit and the Ankle Express. In the newsletter, we also ask, if coral could talk, would it scream for help? Paul Homewood, with a hat tip to friends of science, notes a study out of Fiji that shows that water temperatures there were at least as high 600 years ago as they are today. That is, yes, during the dreaded medieval warm period. And then the authors add an unrelated data set for the very recent past in order to sow panic anyway. But as Homewood says, quote, splicing of data in this way is a strict no-no in any statistical analysis, end quote. Except, we add, when it comes to climate science. In which field, scientific activism emails that, quote, fossil fuel industry representatives are infiltrating science curriculum decision-making in many states, end quote. Boo. And the hook here is that while the good guys just wanted students neutrally to, quote, describe efforts to mitigate climate change, end quote, a sinister, quote, in-house attorney for Shell Oil Company, end quote, successfully argued that instead the kids should be forced to, quote, describe the carbon cycle, end quote. Imagine making young people do science, not activism, in science class. It's an outrage. In the newsletter, we also pointed out a weird but common confusion on climate. News stories and opinion columns, even those that are at odds with much of climate orthodoxy, for instance, an editorial in favor of Canadian oil and gas, routinely say things like that Canada only accounts for, quote, 1.5% of global greenhouse gas emissions, end quote, well, what they really mean is human-made greenhouse gas emissions. And it's an important distinction, because the natural cycle remains far and away the most important source of CO2. And that means that if it's in flux for any reason, such as warming oceans degassing carbon dioxide, it doesn't just dwarf what all Canadians emit, but what all Americans, all Chinese, or all of humanity emits. The critical point here is that human greenhouse gas emissions are far smaller than natural ones, so it's very important not to confuse them. Now, on the subject of policy, we note that a heat map newsletter warns about an Inflation Reduction Act program which supposedly installed 50,000 solar projects in low-income communities, yet, quote, new data provided exclusively to heat map shows just how complicated it is to get money where it needs to go, end quote. To which we might well report, no duh or something, more than half a century after the war on poverty led to massive increases in federal government spending, ambition, outreach, profligacy, and debt, but also to a massive underclass, homelessness, addiction, and just about everything bad, but no apparent decrease in poverty. On the other hand, if zealots for a government Green New Deal are starting to realize that there's more to it than spending and cheering, we could be getting somewhere. But on the downside, you know that when climate alarmists deny that they're coming for your gas stove, it's time to padlock the thing in place, right? Well, not only that. Climate Depot alerts us to a Bloomberg piece claiming that refrigerating food is for planet-destroying losers. So, you better padlock your fridge as well. And this is weird because there was a time when people would have celebrated an achievement like having huge numbers of us able to eat fresh, varied food at all times of year, cooked with a marvelous source of heat that goes on when you want and off when you want. But no, they're just one more disaster in our catalog of sins against Gaia, so they are coming for your stinking fridge. This puff piece about Nicola Twilley, author of Frostbite, How Refrigeration Changed Our Food, Our Planet, and Ourselves, says, quote, "Food waste is often touted as the reason to build a cold chain," Twilley says on the Week's Zero podcast. "The problem is that in the developed world, we are throwing away 30 to 40% of our food at the retail and consumer end," end quote. Okay, you got us. We personally just took Roz Chast's classic Journey to the Center of the Refrigerator, and we found some items that we had believed were extinct that could well have rendered us so had we eaten them. And yes, our Scottish ancestors shook their gory locks at us when we discarded them instead. But a crucial point to grasp here, and to appreciate, is that for 99.99%+ of human history, there was so little to eat that throwing food away really was an act of insanity, and people were willing to eat almost anything, including an oyster or a snake. Nowadays, we can actually afford to throw away more food than is really good for our characters. But that's progress, it just has a bit of a downside. Well, not if you believe this person. Oh, and another thing, the piece quotes Twilley calling the idea that meat protein is good for you, quote, sort of a sad mistake in the history of science, end quote, and then she claims, quote, "We could have had a very different world if those scientists had been like, we all need to eat lentils," end quote. So, these people think you're so dumb that you only think steak tastes better than peas porridge, which incidentally anyone who could afford to spiked with bacon and ham back in the day, because some authority figure told you so. And they also believe that you will accept that you didn't really want a fridge if an authority figure now tells you that. And believe me, they're going to, while denying any plans for a ban, then bringing one in favor of root cellars and organic, locally sourced hair shirts. As for what might be coming instead, according to a Canary Media email alert, the hot new thing is solar? No. Wind? No. Nuclear? Certainly not. Hydrogen? No. Instead, it's next-gen geothermal, and it's all the rage. Quote, "Sage Geosystems has unveiled a huge generation deal with Meta just after announcing its first commercial geothermal storage project earlier in August. Oh, and the U.S. government dropped $31 million for geothermal projects yesterday. It's a real groundswell of support," end quote. No. In reality, a demonstration project for vast virtue-signaling social media platform and a big government subsidy don't add up to a groundswell of support, they testify to its conspicuous absence. On a happier note, this week we continued our cheerful chart series with a look at how far Americans drive versus emissions of carbon monoxide, a genuinely nasty pollutant, unlike CO2. It's based on data from FRED, which is the Federal Reserve Economic Data. So, here's miles traveled, rising fast. And here's total national CO emissions plummeting. That's according to U.S. Environmental Protection Agency data. And all of it without a carbon tax. It shows the power of technology and innovation, in this case, improved engine efficiency and the invention of catalytic converters. But nothing similar currently exists for CO2, which, fortunately, isn't a real pollutant anyway. Either way, we offer this week's cheerful charts as a reminder that innovation and ingenuity can solve real environmental problems in ways that allow us to keep enjoying life, including freedom to travel. And another thing, Roger Pilkey Jr. recently asked whether we're seeing a, quote, hurricane forecast bust of historical proportions, end quote, because the modelers predicted that we'd have a 2024 Atlantic hurricane season far above average, but well into September, the gall-dang climate just refuses to cooperate. Pilkey Jr. cites Colorado State University hurricane expert Philip Klotzbach that we haven't had such a long period with no-name storms since 1968. So, why the dud prediction? Because, as one particularly famous expert mansplained, it's the warming ocean, stupid. But lately some experts are thinking that maybe hurricanes aren't related to greenhouse gases, including 11 scientists who reconstructed hurricane activity back 1,000 years and concluded that they're driven by natural cycles. It's nothing to do with us. And if the true test of science is the quality of its predictions, well, you know from which direction the wind is blowing on this one. Finally, from the CO2science.org archive, evidence that Hordeum vulgare L, also known as barley, also loves CO2. So whether your taste runs to peas, porridge, or Ovaltine, or perhaps malt whiskey or beer, please raise a glass to CO2. For the Climate Discussion Nexus, I'm John Robson, and I already miss summer.
That's right.